from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Fortin. Today we are continuing my ever, or I guess my never-ending crusade, if you want, to try to get as much attention to projects that I think are worthy of attention. Now, unfortunately, last time we did this, we weren't able to pull it off. If you recall the project, the animated project that we had tried to support, unfortunately, that didn't make it. Although now I have someone who has actually already succeeded in achieving her financial goal on Kickstarter, but I think that we can do a lot better, and I think that the project is worth enough that we should really pay attention, and I think that she deserves as much help as possible. My guest today is Bridget Gotet. She is the author of the upcoming book, Grieving for the Living, Effects of Disownment in Adulthood, and she's also the development director of the Foundation Beyond Belief. Thank you for joining me, Bridget.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I'm going to probably mispronounce it. Did I say Godet or instead of Godet like I should have?
You did. I said Godet.
But... See, it's because I'm French. I can't help it. As soon as I see G-A-U, it doesn't matter how much you tell me that it's supposed to be pronounced like G-O-D. I ain't going to do it.
I will forgive you. You can't help that you're Canadian.
There you go. I'm already been forgiven. Now, tell me and our listeners right now a little bit about your project, because I was completely intrigued. What does grieving for the living mean exactly?
Well, it all started with a blog post, actually. And I will get into why I was disowned later, but I was talking about the experience in the blog, and it got a huge response. I was the most hits I've ever had of any of my blogs. And I met so many other people that have been disowned. One of them was a girl who lives in Florida like me, and we got to talking, and we're like, you know, there's a lot of people that are going through this, so why don't we write a book? We both happen to be social workers also, so we deal with we see a lot of people that are rejected by their family, and it kind of just blossomed from there. The two of us got together and we thought, okay, let's include our stories, and we're going at it from several angles. I personally am an atheist, and mine had to do with religious beliefs or disbelief. Hers was she married a guy who wasn't as rich as her mother wanted him to be, so she got disowned. But we also are looking at people who, you know, transgender, gay, even people that have been convicted of crimes, anybody that's been disowned. Now, yeah, I guess that's it. What was your question? I get to go and talking about it.
Well, like, I mean, let's backtrack a little. You said you started this. When did this actually begin? When, like, did you sit down and say, let's start putting some real words to paper here?
Not very long ago. I want to say at the beginning of the year, maybe.
So this is, we're just witness to this as it is just slowly blossoming here.
Correct.
That's what we're seeing. And this is what compelled you. At what point did you decide, now we need to move to Kickstarter? And what is the purpose of you trying to get money on Kickstarter?
That's a good question. Well, initially we were going to try to self-publish, and it costs money to do that. Like I said, we're both social workers, so neither one of us had much money. And in order to self-publish and get, you know, the printing done, proper marketing, graphic design, it can cost sometimes, you know, $1,500, $2,000. And so we wanted to raise money for that, and we wanted a kind of a neat way to market our book, and Kickstarter is a good place to go. You know, you make a little video, and, excuse me, it's easier to kind of get the word out about the book and the project.
Well, the way I mean, when I did my Kickstarter campaign, the idea that I had behind it was not just the fact that, well, here I can get some money, but, I mean, in a sense, Kickstarter becomes a place where you're actually starting off the sales of the book.
Yeah, that too.
So, I mean, that can be an important way, especially for self-publishers that don't have the kinds of, you know, the kind of distribution that publishing places have. So, I mean, there's definitely that advantage. And that's another reason, I mean, that's probably the first reason that I wanted to bring you on the show. Because, like I said, I like to make people aware of some of the things that are happening in the scene. And you know it can be difficult to get the word out, even though, you know, we're highly connected as mm-hmm. a group to the internet. But there really is just, there's no surefire way to be able to say, you should all be paying attention to this one thing right now. Because all of our attention is split off into about a billion different ways. You know, from say, homeopathy to fighting mm-hmm. Mormonism mm-hmm. or Scientology. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're pretty much all over the fucking place. Would you agree?
I absolutely agree. And there is a constant call for funding for projects. So I know for me, even if it's $5 here or there, I give away, well, I don't want to say give away, but I donate a lot of money because there are so many really good causes. And part of this thing was you don't hear a lot about adults being disowned. So I'm like, this is pretty unique. Let's give a little focus to this area. And you're right. What you said about, you know, if you give away the book as one of the perks on Kickstarter, that's another way to get it out there. And ultimately, that's what I want. This isn't about making money. I don't expect to make, you know, become a millionaire off of this. I really just want people to see that this is a problem. It causes a lot of pain, and there hasn't been much research about it.
Well, one of the things that I thought was probably the most interesting of your project was you wanted to do a survey.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been talking about this with members a lot and said, well, as a fledgling community, because I wouldn't even necessarily use that word very strongly. I mean, there are elements of it, but as a group, we're pretty much like it's still the herding cats phase.
Yes.
And the issue that we have right now, and one of my future guests actually wrote a book called Mom and Dad, I'm an Atheist. And one of the questions that I wanted to ask him, and this is not addressed in his book, but I'm going to pre-ask him, hopefully he'll listen to this and prepare himself for that show, mm-hmm. is saying, really, have we understood the consequences of our own increased confidence in our atheism? In other words, what are the externalities? What is the collateral damage that's occurring? Because now, at least within isolated areas in America or in Canada or around the world, it's okay for you to come out. So there can be a kind of false confidence that a person has and be like, well, I'm just going to tell the truth to my family members,
wow.
my friends, not realizing that such a thing might get their asses on the street. And my question
is, I love you right now.
How? See, you should have listened to my show before. How many people are we sort of like selling down the river by just assuming that words alone are enough?
That is a great point, and I love that you bring it up. And I'm going to briefly talk about this blog I'm writing about Black atheism. I have a lot of people that want to contribute and kind of get their name out there and talk about being a Black atheist. And I always kind of, I'm like, you know, hold back a little bit, because especially within the Black community, atheism is really, really taboo. And I'm like, you know, I'm going to put you out there. You're going to be on the internet, and you never know how people are going to respond. And I'm, you know, I have the best example of that. When I rejected my religion, my parents fully disowned me. I haven't talked to my brothers in 12 years. I haven't talked to my father, I mean, but maybe a couple times. And so it's really serious. And there's a lot of, you brought up my survey, what it is meant to do, and of course this is all self-reported, and you know, you have to take that in consideration, but it's to measure the effects of, you know, disownment on mental health. Like, we're measuring, you know, how a person's, you know, depression was before or after, or suicidal thoughts, abandonment issues. And really though, we're hoping too that since we have limited resources, that someone will see this and, you know, someone that has more resources, maybe a college or whatever, and they can do some really good scholarly research on the subject.
Well, I'm hoping definitely that that's going to encourage it, because, you know, the fact that we don't know the numbers is the part that bugs me the most. And if we mm-hmm. have to draw parallels between atheism and homosexuality, and I think that we can, I think that we can look at the numbers because they seem somewhat similar, like mm-hmm. at this point. And, you know, how many young gay kids living on the streets because of the influence of them coming out.
And that is, if looking at my survey, I mean, it's not completed yet, you know, the number of respondents, but those are the two groups that are very overrepresented, you know, gay people and people that have rejected religion. So, I mean, from the research that I've done, it's in the hundreds of thousands, people that have at some point in their life suffer from some kind of parental rejection, and yet there isn't much research. The articles that I've found have been, some have been like 20 years old. There just hasn't been, I don't know why. I think that we have this kind of illusion, like you said, that coming out is so much easier now that people aren't dealing with this kind of thing, and they are. And they're, you know, the ones that are dealing with it, even if we're in the minority, are kind of falling by the wayside. There's no focused therapy for, you know, I say grieving for the living because grief is normally, you know, for someone that has passed, and there's a lot of bereavement counseling, but it's really different knowing that my mom lives, you know, three blocks over and refuses to see me, all because, you know, I'm gay or I decided I want to be Catholic instead of Protestant. So it's crazy.
Well, you work for a fairly large nonprofit organization now, trying to get funding from people. And let me ask you this question. Mm-hmm. Now, if tomorrow we found out that there were 100,000 atheist kids homeless, depressed, alone, with no real sort of like, at least in the immediate fucking future, would we be able to galvanize ourselves, or are we still those same fucking cats that think that as soon as they're done with belief that they're done altogether? Like, where, at what point can we finally start seeing that it's all of our responsibility and that we're really not done yet? Like, how do we get that message out to people?
I don't know that I can answer that question, but I will tell you this. Since I started this project and I'm realizing how many people are affected by this, I'm thinking about, you know, starting my own nonprofit. My degree is actually in nonprofit management, and I'm seeing there's an obvious need that's not being addressed. And for the people that, you know, it happens to them tomorrow, I don't know. And trust me, I want to help all of them. Part of my survey, there's a little comment section, and I've gotten the most heartbreaking stories, and I want to help everybody. There's one guy, he's 74 years old and was recently disowned by his parents. And I'm like, he's 74 at the end of his life, or pretty close, and he's been rejected because he finally saw the light about, you know, God and belief. And I'm like, what can I do for this guy other than say I understand? And for right now, that's kind of what I'm focusing on. Not feeling alone is really huge. When I wrote my blog and I got all these responses, it helped me. But in the end, we really do have to kind of get together and see this isn't so easy for everyone. You know, I have also a friend that's an ex-Muslim. When she left, she had death threats that she had to deal with. It wasn't like she could just say, hey, I'm an atheist, and everybody's like, okay, cool. She's got to worry about where she's going to live. Or if she's going to live.
Well, I have several fans that are in countries that I tell them, you know, flat out, don't come out to your parents.
Yep.
Keep this to yourself. And in a way, you know, part of the problem is that the movement so far, at least in North America, has been dictated by the group which sees typically the least amount of discrimination. So this is sort of like rich white people. Who are not really, or at least well-to-do white people, who are not really used to what the consequences of coming out when you don't live in some ivory fucking intellectual tower where coming out is like, oh yeah, well, your brother Gary's a scientist too, so we kind of expected that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, whenever in the community you ask, how come there aren't more women? How come there aren't more minorities? And you're just like, for the simple reason that there's a real consequence to those individuals if they come out. I mean, maybe if you're just some, you know, guy in middle age who is able to sort of like say to everyone around them, fuck off and I don't need you, maybe that's okay. But with most people, I mean, they are trapped in this kind of situation where they don't want to be disowned, and yet they feel so alone because, as we mentioned before, I mean, you wrote an article, found that other people were like you, and then that gave you a sense of calm, purpose, whatever. Why are we still denying that this is something that we need? Why are we still a group that's like, oh, well, I don't need anybody? Really, is that so? Well, if that's the case, you are a freak, as opposed to everybody else who absolutely definitely needs people and are faced a situation like you where they just get rejected simply because they refuse to accept something that they just cannot accept.
Right. It's all of the individuals that I've come across, almost all, it's been about living honestly. I could pretend to be, you know, I was raised a Jehovah's Witness. I don't know if I brought that up before, but I could pretend to be a Jehovah's Witness and, you know, be repentant for all the bad deeds that I did and
just
have
by living, basically, you're sinning already.
So. Right. Exactly. It doesn't matter that I volunteer hundreds of hours a year, that I have a master's degree, I've been married for 12 years, I live a good life, never been arrested. My parents don't care. It's all about religion. And it's pretty devastating. The average person, you don't really think about how, you know, your mom not being there. And then when you get older, you know, you kind of accept that they're going to die. But I'm going to live out my life with no parents. I didn't get walked down the aisle when I got married. I didn't have anybody there when I, you know, got my degrees clapping for me. There's a lot of little things that you don't realize how much you need your parents. And
well, maybe there's a weird, this is going to sound almost callous and cold.
Do it.
But there's at times when the people that you love have completely blocked you off and they're still alive, it can be worse than if they had all died in a fucking car crash, because at least then you can move on. Right? Then you don't have a fucking daily reminder of their existence. And I'm like, I think that's what I liked about your title. It made sense. Grieving, because it is like losing someone, except for in whatever way they interact with you unofficially, it's that constant little fucking knife right in your side poking you, reminding you of what you've lost. And that's horrible.
And my mother, she likes to call me every 6 months. And there's two things that she wants to know. One, am I pregnant? I'm not sure why that's such a big deal. And two, you know, do I want to accept God back into my life? And it's like, you know, 5 months and 29 days into it, I'm like, finally, I'm okay. I'm feeling better. And then she calls me again and, you know, stabs me in my heart. And the conversation's always only like 5 minutes. And, you know, she asks those two questions. I'm like, nope, still an atheist.
You're getting a call from a ghost, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and imagine that imagine the pain that you would feel if, you know, you have this person you love that passes away, and yet every once in a while you get a visit and you're reminded of all the things that you're missing out on.
All the things that you could have, which is, again, probably the second thing that's just so tantalizing. It's like, if only this person would unshackle themselves from this idea that is literally cost me a life with them, then everything would be better. But you know it is an impossibility, that their mind has basically shackled themselves to it, and they will not let themselves go. It's over. It's like, well, this is the belief that I'm going to die with.
Yeah, and I think that there's two things with that. One, my parents have always believed this way, and part of me doesn't want to take that from them. There's kind of this, you know, that whole ignorance is bliss thing. Thinking that you have it all and that you're going to live forever in some perfect paradise is comforting. They're in their 60s now, and I would hate to take that from them. But then again, I'm like, but I want my mommy sometimes, you know? I want you in my life, and I've had fertility issues. So I don't have – my husband is literally my family, and that is so sad to me. I'm like, other people have a mother and a father and brothers, and I don't really feel like I have that. So it's not cool.
Well, you said that you wanted to start your own nonprofit. You know, one of the things that I always joked with my groups and my members was the fact that if I ever, you know, got some serious money and wasn't so destitute, I would want to start an atheist hostel, if you want. That basically, if you're one of those abandoned people, we send you fucking money for a bus ticket, and then you come over, and then you can at least get back on your feet, talk to other people that are similar. I mean, I think that at least something like that could be the fucking basic thing, right?
We need to get together on this. I love it. Like almost an atheist commune.
Well, no, totally. I mean, and I'd have my editor, Tammy, who's already done this for years, by the way. She's had like countless of people who were kicked out very much in the same fashion that, you know, you were kicked out either because of homosexuality or because of atheism. And I'm sure there's tons of other people that are just like that, saying like, hey guys, do you want to help out with this idea? It's a really simple one. It's kind of similar to what the hippies did when they were like, come to San Francisco. And I'm like, we need something similar. We need a new atheist mecca. We get ourselves a couple of fucking buildings. All right. It won't cost that much. And then we just send out some bus tickets to kids who are on their fucking own and in the street and saying, like, this is not needed. This is not necessary anymore.
And I hope your listeners understand that we have not talked about this before. And I have been thinking about this totally. And I'm like, one of the things also that I'm like, these people need some kind of therapy that we can provide. I'm like, but just having a new family, one of the things that I've been thinking about doing is sort of like promoting an orphan Thanksgiving or an orphan Christmas, where you connect with other people in your area that have kind of, that have been disowned for whatever reason. And instead of spending Thanksgiving by yourself, or maybe just you and one other person, you have this network of people. But what you're saying is kind of the same thing. You already have like this family that you're building, you know, family of choice.
Right. I mean, one of the sad things that we have in the scene is, like I said before, we're convinced that as soon as we detach ourselves from all religions, that the quote-unquote trappings of it are the things that we get rid of as well. Although we don't realize that, I'm like, some of those things that we call trappings, an institution that kind of binds people in a makeshift family, has huge fucking advantages. Right? It's like, and you know, not to denigrate the Foundation Beyond Belief or any of these other kind of organizations that atheists donate money to. I'm like, okay, sure, fine. They go to great causes. But we're not done. We don't even have the ability. Like, as far as I'm concerned, all of that money, every single fucking penny that doesn't get spent to a kid that's on the fucking street because you and I are so confident about our atheism that we can boast about it and just tell everyone else about it and give them that confidence without understanding those consequences. I'm like, until those people are taken care of, stop fucking giving money to other things. You know, there are things to do within this group, within this community. We have only begun. We're so at the beginning of this that we don't even know we're not doing properly. And this is the part that annoys me.
You're making that such good points. I have no argument against that.
Well, I do know that it's tough because, you know, even in my situation, I've been trying to help create a bit of a culture of participation and giving on the parts of people who listen. This is why you're on the show. This is why a whole bunch of other people on the show. My rule is generally, look, I'm interested in getting people to be aware of individuals or movements or stuff like that that maybe everyone else isn't. And yes, my reach is tiny, and I admit how small it is. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that we all have to kind of pick, like, do whatever we're best at. If what I'm good at is yelling very loudly and chastising people for not taking part in the scene, such is my lot. I will continue to do so. But at the end of the day, we all need to do something. And, you know, you mentioned saying, like, you want to move beyond what you're doing now. And I think, and I'm predicting this is going to happen, is that by the time you're finished this book, you will feel like you have no choice but to. Like, I don't see any other future because you'll be outraged.
Mm-hmm. I'm already getting there. Because, I mean, it's one thing to write down your feelings and blog. But like I said, I'm getting all of these comments and emails, and I was on the news actually recently, the local news, and that got a big response too. And I'm like, okay, this has to be something done about this. This is absolutely ridiculous.
Well, we have, you know, I think that we need to also understand, we find ourselves in a bit of a position of saying, well, how do we move forward? You know, I get people, they ask me, what should I do? And then most of the time I just say, well, you know, join an existing movement. It's usually the easiest way, and at least you can gain some experience. Because if you're new in it, at least find out what it's like. But when that's done, I mean, I got news for everybody. We're not even close to having this shit figured out. And while there are tons of groups out there and I like what they do, I would do things completely fucking different from them. You know, I don't have the same attitude that, say, a billboard is the best way to go. That's the best use of $10,000 fucking dollars. Maybe it was in the beginning. But it's basically gone. I mean, you know what I could do with $10,000? I could give one city free internet. That's what I would do with it. And then I would say, we're going to give you something invisible that does exist. Because the internet is what makes atheists. Everything else, you know, any articles I've written or even every podcast that I've made, it doesn't fucking matter. I could distribute that. And no consequence. But if I distribute the Library of Alexandria in your pocket for free, we'll have atheists in two generations guaranteed. The whole place. You just need to give people internet access. And that would be a pretty fundamentally different shift from the way that we've been looking at things, right? We look at it from the perspective of let's advertise, I say, fuck that. You don't need advertising. Just give people knowledge. They'll come to atheism. That's what you just expect.
So why do you think we do that? I mean, why do we think a billboard is the best way or blogging about it? I mean, I often think I'm preaching to the choir in most of these circumstances, and that ultimately isn't doing anything. And I know with me, you know, I'm not an atheist because I ran across a billboard, and yet that's what we keep doing.
Well, it's tough. I mean, here's the thing. The blog part I can totally understand because moving from belief to disbelief is a fucking gradual process. So yeah. The thing is, you know, maybe they need to read 100 articles before they're finally, oh, okay, I get it now. I mean, it's very rare that one person's like, I read this one thing and totally changed my mind. So that part I do understand. The billboards, I mean, that's just, at least as far as I'm concerned, a bit of a lack of imagination on our part. We don't quite know what to do. Billboards are effective and they get attention, especially in traditional media. But whether or not that's effective, I don't know. Whether or not that's the best use of that money, again, I don't know. I feel like no one has actually ever asked themselves the question, are conferences, billboards, and these things really the best way of trying to get, you know, atheists to unite, to form communities, to move beyond this little, you know, internet fad thing that we have mm-hmm. and start actually having physical contact with one another in a way that's, you know, meaningful and actually grows stuff. That's our next challenge when we realize, well, we need to do something different. And I see some of it being fulfilled, like, for instance, in England where they have this fun church that they're doing. And while not every atheist agrees with that, I'm like, look, they go over there, they play music, they have philosophical discussions, and everybody said they had a grand old time enough that they're already franchising. So, if somebody asked me, what are we to do next? We'd be like, well, what is getting people excited? And why aren't we doing this? Like, everything that we do is just kind of like, well, it's almost like our own tradition. We're just going to do what we did before because imagination is difficult.
Well, on that note, let me pimp Foundation Beyond Belief a little bit, because I think the one thing it does do is it is hopefully, once it gets bigger too, changing the perception of atheists a little bit, that we're not all, you know, there's still this stigma against it, but if people see that we're making efforts to help make the world a better place, maybe that can help. I don't know that that would change anybody's idea about.
See, I still think that's very much the billboard idea. What we're trying to do is we're trying to change people's perceptions, and I think that we should do what, when I interviewed Leo Igwe, who tries to fight child witches in Africa. So this is a man who's accustomed to the front
line. We are a huge supporter of his, by the way, and we're starting a drive for him next week.
Okay, well, good. So you know who I'm talking about here.
Yes.
And Leo blew my mind when I interviewed him, because he said something that I could not deny, is he's like, forget about all this conversations of whether or not we, you know, like, should we work with these groups? Shouldn't we work with these groups? You lead by example, mm-hmm. right? That's the most important thing. But I feel like for us, the leading by example happens on the grassroots. Fuck trying to
Absolutely.
Be like famous and be like, look at us, we're just as generous. No offense to your foundation, by the way, when I say that. But my general attitude is when it comes to the groundwork, the real grassroots shit, we haven't even started, right? We just did what, you know, everybody else just did before, in a sense. And that's my biggest fear. And this is actually why I liked your project. I think it shows not only imagination, but it taps into an aspect of our disbelief that we haven't really had the courage to deal with. As in, what is the fucking consequence of this? Who's getting hurt in this whole newfound confidence, in this new voice that we have? Who's the fucking, you know, collateral damage in this?
Yep.
Now tell me about your lack of belief, because apparently it's hot and spicy and all kinds of things that give, you know, me good ratings. So why did you go from Jehovah's Witness to being, an apostate?
Well, I mean, I was born into the religion and I believed it wholeheartedly. I was a Bible literalist until I started college. I believed that the earth was about 6,000 years old and that, you know, Adam and Eve spawned the entire human race. A couple of
years. Are you saying this, burying your head, your face in your hands, or something? You're saying you're like,
oh, absolutely.
I believe this. God.
I mean, it's now. I consider myself a pretty intelligent woman, and the fact that it wasn't so long ago that I had these beliefs it's embarrassing to me. I know it's not my fault. It's what I was indoctrinated with, but anyway, when. So that's just kind of a setup for the kind of girl that started college. I was completely ignorant to...
Gullible as shit.
Extremely.
Right.
So when I went to college, you know, I took these great classes and all that, but another thing I was exposed to was boys. Well, let me say, men.
So you hadn't been in high school? Like, they did a good job at pretty much getting you on that whole abstinence bandwagon? What's the deal?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I was a virgin, and I was going to stay that way until I got married, and I guess my libido just hadn't kicked in yet, because once I went to college, I was surrounded by, and also, I don't know, it was just boys in high school, and I realize now I'm attracted to much older men, so, but that's a whole different thing. But once I started school, I don't know, something just kicked in. I had these urges, and I had these guys that were interested in me, and I realized I'm more interested in sex than God, and that actually helped get me questioning things. I'm like, how can this be
so much better than God?
Right. And then once I had sex, I was hooked. So, and I talk about this a lot, about how my orgasm, how my libido helped me become an atheist. I think if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have let the other, you know, the science and the philosophy, I would have been able to still dismiss that. But something about the sex just made me...
That's an interesting thing. I like how it was sort of... It's just basically, it was so good that everything else in my life seemed crappy that had been sold as saying, well, God is all good. Really? Then why is it someone playing with my clit is like a zillion times better?
Exactly. And so yeah, I give a lot of credit to, you know, the lovely brain chemicals that get released and all that. But, yeah, so that's, I don't have the nice, you know.
No, well, no, you have a much, you don't need the nice thing. Fuck the nice thing. That's just for boring people. You have I fucked my way out of religion story, which I think is like a zillion times better.
That could be like a documentary. Now, anyway, and I wonder how, you know, I haven't really gotten to discuss that with a whole lot of people, and I don't know if other people have had that experience. Maybe I need to put a call.
I think you should. I mean, first off, anyone who's listening to the show now who has had a similar experience, and with most people, it was probably not as dramatic as why is sex so much better than God. But I would say that probably it breaks off into a couple of different camps. The first camp are the people who have just been constantly told that sex is just all kinds of bad and wrong and naughty, and they just find themselves in a situation where they just don't buy it. I think the problem with a lot of religious people is when they're told that, they actually do buy into it, being like, oh yeah, that feeling that I had that was awesome, I was doing something bad. But with a lot of people that naturally have these kinds of streaks of independence, I think that they would just say, how can something this good be considered bad? And then when you realize where, you know, like, particularly if you're a Christian, you ask yourself, why is masturbation evil? And when you get down to the two stories that they try to use as justification, one is of a guy basically coitus interruptus spilling his fucking sperm on the ground, and the other one is a commandment to be fruitful and multiply, all of a sudden you're like, first of all, it doesn't even say anything about masturbation. One is that it's a Levirate marriage thing that he fucked off on, and I can kind of understand a omnipresent, super in your face God getting peeved about that. But the whole being fruitful, I'm like, I gotta practice. You know what
and
I mean?
I was raised in a very sex negative religion, and I didn't even, and I will tell you, as much as I like sex, I didn't even masturbate until several years into my marriage. So I did still have those hang ups.
Well, no wonder you didn't know until you started actually having sex that it was all good. The rest of us, we already knew.
Well, I don't know. I think it's harder for guys, and women are going to kill me, and I'm a feminist, and they're going to hate me for this, but to resist the temptation to masturbate. So I think girls probably... Well, and the thing is, I actually, now that I think back, I was doing things that were pretty close. Like, you know, I knew that certain things felt good when you rubbed on your comforter a certain way.
Some dirt trails home just seemed better than others.
Yeah, exactly. So...
Well, you might be right about the masturbation thing, but to be fair, I think it's just merely a matter of biology. I mean, it's just hanging out there. You know what I mean? And it's most of the time, it's even you wake up and it's just begging for you to. It's just like, either that or I'm going to pee crooked, so it's up to you. So tell me a little bit more about this book that you're writing. First off, You said you're co-writing it, right?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your co-author. So she's religious and she was kicked out for a different reason?
No. She actually considers herself an agnostic atheist. That's actually what I call myself too. The reason why we connected is just because she responded to my blog, and it was so weird because, like, our husbands, once we got to talking, our husbands had the same name. We're both social workers from Florida. So we kind of just connected on that level. Her name is Emma Slyerverse. I should tell you that. And
how do you pronounce this? Slyerverse?
Slyer. S-L-I-E-R.
Never heard of it.
It's not. It's Slyer. Can you edit that?
Depends if you're nice enough. I might edit that.
Right. Emma Slyer. No, Slyer. I'm saying it wrong again. It's pronounced. She says it's like Pier. Sorry. Emma Pier. Slyer. I don't know why I can't get that. I promise I haven't been drinking.
You're a bad friend. That's what.
So, we just had a lot in common, and we wrote to each other mostly, and she wrote really well, and she writes more creatively than me. Like, I'm very technical, you know, I can get the grammar and the syntax right, but she kind of can get more inspirational. And so, her mother disowned her because apparently Emma was engaged to this guy who had a lot of money, and her mother was very much about appearances, and it looks really good that her daughter's gonna marry this rich guy, but it wasn't meant to be. Emma fell in love with a guy who makes average wages. Heaven forbid. And her mother, like, took it as a personal affront. And I believe that her mother still has contact with this guy, even though Emma doesn't talk to him, and even though she doesn't talk to Emma, her mother, I'm like, well, they need to get together then if she likes him so much.
Well, maybe that was kind of her real secret Mrs. Robinson-like dream here. How could you, and I'm assuming that she's probably not financially rich herself, so this is kind of like the princess and the pea kind of thing in her mind, or what's the deal?
I actually don't know that, and I know that her mother, her parents are divorced. I don't really know, actually, her mother's financial
situation.
Seems like
a strange arbitrary. I could understand if she was, like, blue blood style, and then all of a sudden, you know, you run away with the French lumberjack, and it's just basically, how can you do this to the family or whatever. But if you're not part of this social class that obviously has its own problems, then, I mean, maybe is it just that she wants to be part of that social class and would reject her daughter as a consequence? What a strange reason.
I know. Like, there, and that's the thing about this being disowned. Like, you kind of even, like, I can understand kind of why my parents rejected me with the whole religious thing. You can, some of them are clear cut, but, like, with her, it doesn't make any sense. But apparently her mother is very black or white with people, love or hate, so the fact that she's her daughter isn't a big deal. She doesn't like her decision, so she's not going to talk to her. And her cousin is in the same situation. The family doesn't speak to her either. It's really strange the reasons that people come up with. I have another person who's thinking about contributing. Her mother doesn't think she's feminist enough. She's not as radical as she could be. I guess her mother doesn't like that she shaves her legs and wears a bra.
You're joking.
I'm not kidding. The reasons that people find, I mean, there's all, my assumption is with some people, there's some mental illness there. So, but still, it doesn't make any less painful.
Oh, like, no, definitely not. But I think that, see, in those kinds of circumstances, I've definitely been trying to understand where the roots of fundamentalism, if you want, right? Mm-hmm. And not just religious fundamentalism, because that is an element of fundamentalism. And I think that the reason why it's always more prevalent is because it offers a kind of roadmap to fundamentalism, if you want. It's really simple. Just follow the books literally, have an attitude about women that's sort of like dates back to the Bronze Age, and voila, recipe for fundamentalism. But sometimes I think that fundamentalism can be a little bit more organic. Obviously, each person is their own religion, despite, you know, everyone thinking that they're Catholics. They're really just youists. Whatever the fuck you believe in, you know, you'll take an amalgam of them and you'll create your own personal one. And I think that essentially this kind of thing happens even in individuals who aren't specifically in any religion, where they'll just have this totalitarian belief. And I think there's a genetic cause for this. I think that there are some people that are much more prone to fundamentalism because they find something about it, you know, really comforting maybe. Or people who live in absolutes find that it's just, it's reassuring. They don't have to have uncertainty. They're like, well, I reject you, but that's because I basically have accepted God, so I have a very clear path ahead of me.
I agree with you.
So, I mean, like, the problem would be that individuals like us, we throw ambiguity in the mix. Of course they would fucking fear us. Here we're going around saying, like, well, I mean, you yourself, you call yourself an agnostic atheist, which is basically to say, well, I don't really know, but it looks like a no. But, you know, we want to know more. And for individuals that are into totalitarianism, let me tell you something. That's the most frightening fucking thing in the world. It's like, but you don't know? And you're comfortable with that?
But some people, they even feel more comfortable with being with people that feel fully, absolutely, I do not believe this or I do believe this. It's the people that say I don't know that freak them out, because that's a little too middle ground for a lot of people. Like, I say I don't know, but I believe there is no God. I don't know if there's one. And yeah, a lot of people don't like that and it confuses them.
Well, they either two things happen. One is that they will utterly detest you, or two is that they're going to try to convert you. Because as far as they're concerned, a mind that's not made up means that I just haven't told them the right argument yet. Let me turn to page blah, blah, blah of the Bible.
Well, hey, I was a Jehovah's Witness. I know all about converting people. In fact, when I started college and I met my husband, you know, I was still a Jehovah's Witness and I still believed it all very firmly. But I wanted to have sex and do that whole thing. But my plan was to convert him later. But it didn't work. The opposite happened.
Your husband's he was an atheist before he dated you?
Yes. He was an atheist when I met him, so.
What's his style of atheism? Is he sort of like more quiet? Does he talk about it? Or are you now the big atheist pusher now?
He is what I call an apathetic atheist. I think with a lot of people that, like, he never believed. So I think people that are in that situation tend to be less vocal about it. He supports me in all my efforts, but he doesn't involve himself in anything. You know, I'm the one organizing protests and volunteering for these different organizations, and he's kind of like, whatever.
That sounds like the average atheist.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like about 90% of us. Oh, whatever.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm angry about it. Like, I feel like like we talked about earlier, how embarrassed I am that I believed. And I was one of those Christians that would get into arguments with atheists and be like, I didn't come from no monkey. And, you know, like, just the most ignorant stuff. And I'm like, that used to be me. But I think that's why I try to approach this from a little bit more of a caring aspect. And I do care about those that have been hurt by their belief, by just trying to live honestly. And although I was a state director for American Atheists for a little bit, you know, the ones who do the billboards and that are kind of a little bit more out there, I found more comfort in doing the work that I do now, more charitable stuff. But, I mean, I support it all, really.
Well, we have to have different approaches, right? That's mm-hmm. why anyone, you know, like if Chris Mooney of, you know, Unscientific American says, we need to be accommodationist. I'm like, well, you're half right. You're exactly half right, because the other half cannot be. The other half has to be outraged, angry, fucking righteous indignation. Own that shit, because eventually you have to realize that all of this was just not only a gigantic waste of time, all right, but it still is tearing families apart. It's fucking the motivation between little girls getting shot in the face mm-hmm. because they're trying to get educated, or acid thrown in their face. All matter of human horror visited on people because, like I said before, this is a, you know, faiths are things that lead to totalitarian thought. It's ingrained in them. It's almost like they can't help it. They utilize, in fact, that very phenomenon in people. They're like, oh, are you a monkey that can easily get hooked to an idea and would do anything, including sacrifice your life for it? Geez, that sounds fucking useful. Let me come up with a few.
Oh, God. Depresses me. You're making me sad.
Well, you know, part of what the good atheist experience is that first I must make you sad, and then I rebuild you. You see, from the rebuilding, I give hope. And the hope is that people like you, who are starting to go out there and are trying unorthodox ways to make a difference, I think are going to achieve some success at it. I mean, you say you don't want to be rich. Maybe the book's not going to make you wealthy, but I think that at the very least you're dealing with a subject matter that more and more people are going to be curious about, because once you really put that in people's faces, it's going to be difficult to ignore.
And that's part of the reason why I wanted to add in the survey element, actually, because I think it helps legitimize it a little bit. You know, I could have, initially we were like, okay, well, let's just put 20 personal stories together, and that's great. But I think that we needed to go a step further with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, anecdotes are fine, but we need a bit of numbers here. We need to put that thing into perspective, because, again, I mean, you might be stuck with the problem that if you give me a book of 20 anecdotes, I might just think, well, that's 20 people. How many can there really be? So, I mean, you're kind of caught in a weird place, because a lot of times using personal stories is a good way of, like, showing the personal face of whatever it is you're trying to deal with. But the first and most important part is really, at least in my view, is to get everyone to know what those numbers actually are. So that we can just, like, get the veil removed from our eyes and see that, hey, you know, when you're dealing with countries with hundreds of millions of people, then that means that even if there's only a small percentage of people that are being neglected, that's still hundreds of thousands, millions maybe.
Exactly.
And that's not something that we can easily comprehend, but it's real and it's out there.
And I'm hoping that for that reason the book will be attractive to people that are more interested in the personal, or the people that are more interested in, you know, the science, the numbers. We tried to incorporate both, because there's a book that has really affected me in this, as far as the style it was written. It's called Sex and God by Daryl Ray. And that's what he did. He took this large scale survey, but then he added in, you know, personal touches and all that. And I think it worked really well to, I don't know, legitimize it and make it, I don't know how to explain it, but I liked
it. You liked it so much you wanted to do your own version.
I mean, it was called Sex and God, so that alone is cool, but I just really liked how he formatted the book and that kind of...
Well, at least now you have a kind of roadmap of what you're trying to build. So no one's going to blame you if it seems a little samey, because you're going to be providing lots of interesting stories. I'm sure of the 20 that you're going to be selecting, we're going to have some, like, fairly shocking tearjerkers, is my assumption.
Right. I want you to read the book, and I want you to cry and be angry, and I do want you to have a pretty strong emotional reaction from it, because that's what we're experiencing every day. It's excruciating going through this, knowing that you have family out there that, for whatever reason, has rejected you, usually a reason that's beyond your control. You can't help your sexuality, you can't help your gender. You know, we have trans women and men that have submitted their stories. These are things you can't help, and you want your family too.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've heard about the book is that you have Nathan Phelps, who's going to be doing the introduction. Is that right?
Yes, he is writing the foreword. And for anybody that's not listening, Nathan Phelps is the son of Fred Phelps of the Westboro Baptist Church. The ones who like to picket funerals, and I believe even their website is something like godhatesfags.com. So yeah, it's a very...
One of theirs, yeah. I mean, there's a number of very offensive ones, but that's one of the ones they own.
Yeah, so
I think
he...
one is God Hates Canada is one of the ones they own.
Well, understandable. No, I'm kidding.
It's so cold up here, of course he hates.
Exactly. But yeah, his story is very intense, and he's actually writing a book, you know, detailing everything, but I think that his is extreme. You know, not everybody's the son of a crazy cult member, but it definitely, I mean, it happens, and a lot, he's had sisters and nieces and nephews that have left as well, and it's very painful. He left when he was 18. I mean, I remember when I was 18 how to just leave an environment like that and go off into the world and have no kind of parental support it's brave, but I'm sure that he needed a lot of resources at that time. You know, one of the things that the survey has revealed is a lot of people after they're disowned have very unstable housing. You know, homelessness is...
Well, when you don't have a support network of family or friends, you know, what happens when you face something, some difficulty? Oh, I lost my job. Well, you have no home now.
Yep. So, yeah, I'm really happy that he's involved. There's a couple other people Ashley Miller. She's a blogger at Free Thought Blogs. She recently started dating a black guy, and here in 2013, her father disowned her because of it.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's amazing the reasons that people choose.
Yeah, well, you know, we often find ourselves, I think this is the other, maybe the last reason why some of us may feel so disconnected is that we live in two worlds, right? We live in a world in which interracial, and I fucking hate that word because it doesn't even exist, but differently pigmented people can hook up and it's no big deal, except for it is, in, you know, with a certain segment of the population, with a certain age group, let's say. They live in a different fucking world, and we don't know that these two worlds interact all the time. We think that we're isolated in our own, you know? I know this because, say, I live mostly online. I do. I feel like three-quarters of my life, I live it on a weird electronic screen in which I'm interacting with people. And this place was built by atheists. Name me one operating system that was not designed by a non-believer.
I've never thought about that, but as I think about it, you're right.
Right. The internet is a fucking atheist haven. I mean, every single programmer that has made a significant contribution, probably a fucking atheist. Let's not deny it. This is its own little world, and I think it's the reason why we do so well on it, why our organizations have grown. But this is a fake world. This is a pseudo world. It only interacts with the real one. And the real one are places like in North Dakota where they just made it illegal to have a fucking abortion by declaring a fetus a person. You see the weird dual worlds that we live in? It's like, time for us to fucking wake up. Do I have a new fan of the show, by the way? You seem like
you do, absolutely.
She had never listened to the show, ladies and gentlemen, but now I think that she's going to listen.
I don't know. There's so many out there, and I feel overwhelmed a lot of times, and that's it. There's just so many out there that I want to listen to, and then I get addicted,
I totally, I'm not blaming you. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with you for not having heard the show. I was just pointing out that I think we have a new listener, everybody, and maybe even a new member of the 300, my little exclusive group, if you want. See, you don't know about this because you're relatively new, but what I've decided to do, and this is a little bit of a weird experiment if you want, is I thought, what happens if you have a group of people, but you limit the size, right? Because the thing about the internet is that there are no limits, right? I could fucking make a membership of 10 million people and accept everybody. But I'm like, fuck that. That's not fun. Instead, why don't you create this idea of saying, well, it's really much more limited. And not only is it limited, but we're constantly encouraging everyone who's in the group to leave if they're no longer having fun or think that it's worthy or whatever, right? Because the people who are part of the 300, they're like my congregation. They're the ones who support me, say, like $5 a month. And because I don't have a church to pay for or none of these other things, I'm like, a congregation of 300 is exactly what I need. And some of those people, they either help. I have an editor, or they write stuff. Or, you know, they help illustrate shit. And I figured, you know, with 300 people, you can galvanize a lot of fucking talent. But the thing is, and this is the reason why I selected 300, is that once groups get to certain numbers, it's kind of hard for you to keep track of it. It becomes like sometimes groups suffer from their own size, in a sense.
That absolutely happens. And I have a friend that she has like a Facebook page that is grown, I mean, not page, a group that's grown to like 3,500 people, and she just doesn't know what to do anymore. And I'm like, well, first of all, 3,000, you know, 3,200 of them aren't even engaged. So it's kind of number. So I like your idea. If you can have 300 people that are actually engaged and, you know, motivated for whatever it is you're doing, that is more meaningful than having 10,000 people who just, you know, signed up one day and then forgot about it.
Right, exactly. And I mean, Not to get too biblical here, but in the Bible constantly mentions the number 300. They seem to have a bit of an obsession with it. In fact, Gideon managed to destroy the enemy army with just 300 guys, and he had specifically gotten 300, because anybody else who was not interested or whatever, he said, go fucking home, get out of here. And the guys that drank water like beasts, he said, get the fuck out of here. And at the end, there was only 300 people left, and in a way, I feel like, you know, 300 is about two Dunbars. So Dunbar is the cognitive limit that you can keep in your mind at all times. So I made it two because most of the people who are part of the 300, say 80% of them, they don't actually want to participate most of the time. They want to be like the background atheist, right? They're like, well, you know, as far as they're concerned, funding is enough. And you know that, well, you need a majority of people to just be funders. If everybody is participating, nobody's doing anything.
Yep. So what is your ultimate mission for this group?
This group, well, one of them actually is what we were talking about before. Like, my hope is that eventually when the book comes out, right, that I can have 300 people that are already supporting me, so in a sense, I don't need to extract income from the book. I can take the book monies, and I could put it right back in the group, and then we could start doing some exciting things about having some with having some real fucking money. Do you know, like the fucking hostel idea. There's a bunch of other projects I want to do as well after the book. There's going to be a comic book and all this other kind of stuff, and the 300 are going to be the people that are hopefully going to be helping out with that. But again, I mean, plans are just plans until they come to fruition, right?
I get what you're saying. And I was actually thinking, I mean, the same thing with my book is whatever I raise, I want to be able to put it back into something to further this, you know, particular cause dealing with people that have been disowned. So,
well, right if my on. Model works, maybe you can also adopt the same model. Maybe you can find 300 people that think that you're the shit done? And then just basically be like, that's all I really need. And then from there, you're just like, all the profit that we make goes back to the group, and if the profit is made, it gets to pay salaries of people in the group if they have to devote their full time to it. So essentially, the idea is just saying, I think I'm an industry, and now I just need a whole bunch of people to kind of like hop on board. That's
so when does your book come out?
The book will be coming out around a late fall, early winter of this year. So I'm putting I'm trying to finish the first draft in the next coming week, hopefully in the next 2 months. Then I have like probably 2 solid months of straight illustrations because I have, you know, another 20 some odd drawings left to complete. Because I don't know if you know this, but when I sold the book, I sold people their faces in the illustrations of the various chapters. This is a way that I tried to generate more money. I used the same tricks that Leonardo da Vinci and Raphael and all those other guys use. That you capitalize on people's vanity and you shall go far.
I am sad that I didn't see it at the time because I would have. Totally.
Well, you know, if there's any positions, I think I haven't because there's 33 books of the Old Testament. I think I've fulfilled 32 or 30. I'm not quite sure. But if anybody's out there and they really, really want, I may be able to fit you in because at $250 a pop, I'll fit that bitch in.
Yeah, right? Even if it's somebody that's in a crowd. No, I'm kidding. But yeah.
Well, I think that we'll wrap it up. So I want people to go to the site. There's a Kickstarter link. If you go Grieving for the Living, if you do a search for that, there's also going to be a link on the website and in the lyrics section of the podcast. So please go check that out and support. I mean, you can give a minimum $1 and at least show that this idea has some fucking merit, people. Let's throw a little bit of our support here. It's not much skin off your back. And I think that it's really going to have some pretty positive aspects, and I'll definitely be one of those people that's going to pimp it like crazy when it does come out. And when does this one come out, by the way? When is it scheduled?
We're not sure. And the strange thing is, even though the Kickstarter was started to self-publish, we have had a publisher approach us. So I'm going to talk with him and see what happens with that, and he'll kind of make that determination if I decide to go with them. I don't know. I haven't decided yet.
Well, I'm sure you can negotiate something fairly easily because, like I said, I think this is, you know, people are just going to take notice. I think it's a great idea. So you wouldn't be on the show if I didn't think so.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm serious.
It's my pleasure. Look, this is my job. You're making it easy. I don't have to, like, research any topics. You just come on and talk. You know, research is like a third of my fucking day, so anybody can, you know, relieve that tension. It's great. You did me a favor.
And I like to talk, so it works.
Exactly. There you go. Everybody's happy. All right. Well, I'd like to thank my guest, Bridget Gaudet. I said that right, right?
Correct.
And her upcoming project, Grieving for the Living, Effects of Disownment in Adulthood. Please check it out. With that, my name is Jacob Forte. Have a good Atheist Day, everybody.